Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Stephen Ovitzky about the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival, and we will be speaking with Arthur Z, who has just edited a new book called Chinese Writers on Writing. I'm very happy now to welcome storyteller Joe Hayes. He is in his 28th year, a storytelling series at the Wheelwright Museum, starting this Saturday and Sunday, July 17th and 18th, at 7 in the evening and going 5 weekends in a row. Welcome back to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
It's great to have you. Storytelling is something that you've been doing your whole life. You started out, what, telling stories to your children?
I started out with my children, and my daughter's 41 now, so that gives you an idea of how long I've been doing it. And my dad was my model because he used to tell stories to us when I was a kid.
Did he tell them? Did he read them?
No, he told them. But my dad would mainly tell about things that happened to him when he was a kid or when he was a young man. And I didn't really have the facility for remembering stories like that, so I thought, I'm going to learn traditional old stories, and I love the Southwest. I'll learn old stories from around here, so I'll have them in my head to tell the kids. And that's how it all began.
And that's what you did. So the stories that your father told you when you were young, are those lost? Did you recreate them ever?
Well, no, I really don't recreate them. And so, you know, every once in a while, they'll kind of wander back into my memory. He was the kind of guy where, you know, if you were driving on the street, you saw a billboard, it would make him remember something, and he'd have a story about so-and-so. And he grew up in an Irish enclave in the Boston area. His parents immigrated from Ireland, so he had that whole tradition. And he was very old. My dad was born in 1896. So he grew up at a time when people told a lot more stories about their lives because there was no produce entertainment for them. So that's how they entertained each other.
It's very interesting. So what they say about Irish storytellers and Blarney and all that stuff has some truth to it.
Well, it really seems to have truth to it, yeah. It's a cultural thing, and I think it's something that people of Irish extraction grow up with, and so they sort of acquire that. You know, not that there aren't quiet Irishmen as well, but I think there's a lot of respect within the culture for people who can spin a yarn, and so they're encouraged to do it.
When you look at stories from the Southwest, and you look at Irish stories, and you look at stories from different cultures, are they fundamentally different from each other? Do you see universal themes?
No, fundamentally, they're not different. All around the world, the themes of the traditional stories, and that's what I like to tell our traditional stories, they're very, very similar. So if you read a collection of Irish stories, you'll find variants of stories that you know from the Southwest, that you know from Latin America, that you know from Africa. The same, not only the themes, but even the general plot lines are very similar all over the world.
Isn't that funny? Does that speak, in your view, does that speak to the migration of people and stories, or do they come up with them independently of each other?
Well, that's always been the classic argument among folklorists and people who study, you know, cultures. Is it because human beings are fundamentally the same and go through the same processes of maturation and struggles that they created the same stories no matter what culture they were in? Or is it that many, many stories started in one place and then they spread out? And the truth probably is it's a mixture of both, especially in the old world from Africa, India, all across Europe. The stories did spread because of the Crusades, because of the trade caravans in the Middle Ages, because of the troubadours. The stories just got disseminated all over that part of the world.
What are some of the basic themes that come up universally in all different storytelling traditions? I would guess love, educating children to be good.
Yeah, respect for tradition. The folklore is full of stories that emphasize that material wealth is not real wealth.
Ah.
You know, there's always the poor person who's kind and loving, and they end up successful, and the person who has lots of money but they're greedy and unkind, they always come to a bad end. You find that in every single culture.
Would that it were really so.
Well, it depends what how you define success, I suppose, you know. Another really universal theme is that the person who is despised and disrespected ends up showing everybody that they're actually the smartest one of all. And that's a feeling we all have sometimes. We feel as though people don't really appreciate us, don't really recognize all that we have to offer. But someday I'm going to show them, and they'll see what I really have to give.
Or like the story of Scrooge. He really was awful until he saw the light, and then all these riches that he had inside came out for the first time, or the Grinch.
Yeah, yeah. And those kind of themes are in folklore as well.
So when you start telling these stories, you're going on for 5 weekends at the Wheelwright Museum. Do you tell different stories every weekend?
I do. I try not to repeat myself throughout the 5 weeks. The only time I repeat myself is if some kids show up and say, "Oh, would you tell such and such a story?" And say, you know, I'll say, "I just told that story last week," but they say, "Well, we really wanted to hear that one." So I'll say, "Okay, I'll tell it."
Do you get repeat visitors?
I get a lot of repeat visitors.
There
are many families that come every summer. There are a few families that come every single weekend. They just never fail. They're always there. And one of the wonderful things is there are many families from out of state who return every summer. So I get to see the kids grow up.
Very interesting. What is it about people telling stories to children that the children want to hear the same stories over and over again?
Well, repetition is comfortable for people. And that even though in our culture we're always being told that you should never repeat yourself. What's new is what's best. But if you look at the advertising industry, you see that they understand that people really thrive on repetition. I mean, they create a commercial, and they just play it over and over and over and over. And then they do an abbreviated version of it. Then they do a spin-off from it. So they understand that people really do enjoy repetition, and also it takes quite a few iterations before something really begins to sink in. And I think with the old stories in traditional cultures, you know, people told the same stories every year, probably in the wintertime in most cultures. So the kids would grow up every winter, they heard the same tales, and so if they began to forget about them throughout the other months, then they'd hear them again and get them reinforced.
One of the things of cultures that are not primarily about the written word, but are more about oral tradition, is that storytellers can remember epics. I mean, they can remember incredibly long stories that we supposedly brainy literary types could never possibly do.
Yeah.
How do you do? I mean, are you?
Well, I don't remember anything that long and complicated. I know a lot of stories, but most of them are, you know, 10, 12, 15 minutes long or something like that. So I've never attempted to learn a long, long epic sort of a story like that. I don't know how I would handle that. But again, I think if you're thinking about it constantly, you know, you're sort of reviewing it in your mind, and you tell it over and over again. And of course, for most of the epic stories, they're rhythmic. They're in a somewhat poetic form, and the rhythm of the language is a mnemonic device that helps the teller to remember it, for it to settle into their mind. I guess that's just the way they accomplish it.
So we're talking to storyteller Joe Hayes, and if we're lucky, maybe will you tell us a story?
Well, I'd like to tell you a story. I'm always happy to tell a story. And I think I'll tell a story about Coyote. They say that one time Coyote saw a rattlesnake going from one shady bush to another one. Oh, Coyote always liked to make fun of other animals. He said, "Rattlesnake, you're skinny. You're no bigger around than my front leg." Rattlesnake didn't say anything. He just coiled up in the shade of another bush. But once Coyote starts making fun of another animal, he doesn't like to stop. So he moved over closer to see what else he could make fun of. And when he got a little bit closer, Rattlesnake's tongue went darting in and out of his mouth. Coyote said, "Rattlesnake, is that your tongue? That looks like a piece of dead grass. This is what a tongue is supposed to look like." Coyote hung his long pink tongue out of his mouth and sat there panting. Rattlesnake still didn't say anything. Coyote moved up even closer, and Rattlesnake began to rattle with his tail. Coyote said, "Rattlesnake, is that the music you make? That sounds like a dry bean pod shaking in the wind. I'm a musician. I can sing." And Coyote threw his head back and howled. "Ooh!" Rattlesnake still didn't say anything. So Coyote kicked some dirt in Rattlesnake's face. Then Rattlesnake lifted his head and opened his mouth. Coyote started to laugh so hard he almost fell down. He said, "Rattlesnake, you only have two teeth in your mouth. If you bit me, I would hardly even feel it. I could bite you in half if I wanted to." And then Coyote got an idea. Maybe he could get a meal out of this. There wasn't much meat on that skinny rattlesnake, but he would be something to eat. So Coyote said, "Rattlesnake, let's have a contest. I'll bite you and you bite me. We'll see which one can hurt the other one more." Rattlesnake still didn't say a word. Coyote jumped out and bit Rattlesnake in the middle of his body. And Rattlesnake reached his head around and sank his fangs into Coyote's shoulder. Coyote jumped back. Ow! That hurt a lot more than he thought it would. But then he said to himself, "Oh, well, it's just a bite from two teeth. Pretty soon the pain will go away. And I'll bet Rattlesnake will die before long." He could even see some spots of blood where his teeth had gone through Rattlesnake's skin. So Coyote said, "Rattlesnake, stay under that bush. I'll lie down under this one. We'll see how each one of us feels in a little while." Coyote lay down under the bush, and the pain in his shoulder started spreading all over his body. His head started swimming around. He said, "Rattlesnake, how do you feel?" Rattlesnake still didn't say anything. Coyote said, "I don't feel very well at all." Finally, the sun went down and Rattlesnake went on his way, but not Coyote. He stayed under that bush for 4 days before he could even walk again. He didn't die from the rattlesnake bite. Coyote did recover, but from that day on, when he saw a rattlesnake, he didn't make fun of it, and he sure didn't challenge it to any contests either.
Joe Hayes, storyteller. It's interesting. I was expecting some kind of twist or punchline on that story, but it's just a straight ahead.
Just a straight
ahead
story.
Don't mess with poisonous.
Well, things aren't always the way they appear to be, and that's there's a lot of learning in that idea.
So some stories do have a kind of punchline, so the unexpected twist at the end.
Some of them do, yeah. Yeah, and many don't, and many just come to a conclusion. They wrap up, and the conflict of the story is settled, and that's it. A lot of Native stories don't really come to an end at all, because they just sort of flow from one story into the next and into the next, and more contemporary writers who have set them down sort of organize them into individual stories. But it may have been that originally when they were told, there was no end, because it wasn't a performance where you had to let the audience know now we're at the end of the story, but instead you just sat there and told the stories, and they went on and they went on.
So the stories you will be telling at the Wheelwright Museum are Southwestern stories?
I tell Southwestern stories. I tell the Native American stories and a lot of Hispanic stories, a lot of bilingual stories, and tall tales.
And tall tales. So children, welcome and encouraged to come, children of all ages.
Children of all ages. The cool thing is that typically the group will be two-thirds adult and about one-third children.
Very interesting.
Many of the adults come without a child just to listen to the stories or to watch the kids respond to the stories.
Well, you can't blame them. And children, it's encouraging to know, are not so addicted to their TVs that they don't love stories.
They still respond to the experience of having an adult just offer a story to them. It's still very satisfying for children.
Joe Hayes is a storyteller who will be telling stories at the Wheelwright Museum this Saturday and Sunday, the 17th and 18th of July at 7 in the evening, and then at the same time, 7 in the evening weekends for the next 5 weekends in a row. It's free admission. Everybody is welcome at the Wheelwright Museum. For more information, you can go to wheelwright.org. You can also call 505-982-4636. Joe Hayes, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm delighted now to welcome back to the show Stephen Ovitzky. He is the executive director of the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival, which opens this coming Sunday, the 18th of July. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you, and I can't believe time is accelerating or something. It seems like we just finished last year, and now you're up for a whole new season.
We were just talking about that at our office. One of our summer stage managers is back. And we were all saying it seems like he just left the other day to go back home, and now he's back with us for the summer. And we all decided it's just an age issue.
Oh, dear.
Time is going by more quickly.
I guess it is. But there's some wonderful things happening this summer. Chamber music. We have to always remind ourselves and others, what is chamber music as opposed to orchestral or any other kind of music?
Chamber music is music played usually by one person on a part rather than, let's say, in an orchestra where you have 16 first violins all playing the same part. And it's generally played without a conductor, and it's generally a smaller ensemble. So we'll have anywhere between 1 and maybe 13 or 15 people on stage at any given time. There's an intimacy and immediacy about chamber music that is virtually unknown in any other kind of music. The passionate performance and the individuality of each player working together. So you have great players at our festival who are really putting out a lot of emotional, passionate playing. But at the same time, they have to work together so that everything is together. So
it must be so interesting for people who play as you do. You're a horn player who play in orchestras sometimes, in chamber music other times, to, when you're playing chamber music, not have a conductor and have that, acting as one organism, kind of psychic communication among the instrumentalists.
There's a lot of communication that's unspoken, but rehearsals are about stopping and deciding how something will be done. So sometimes you have differences of opinion in rehearsals about how a certain passage should be phrased, and that gets worked out, and it gets worked out together, and the performance, you'd never know that there were any discussions about it. It just seems unanimous, and that's what makes great chamber music. It's such a passionate art form, and it's so immediate because it's just a few people playing directly to you.
When you are in a rehearsal and you're working those things out and you practice and practice, does this moment come where the whole thing clicks and it goes into a new level of working?
Yes, exactly. And sometimes you'll have that with an ensemble that plays together regularly. At our festival, we bring in mostly individual musicians, and they come together at the festival to rehearse the piece that they're going to play. So it's not like a standing group that comes to a city, plays a string quartet concert, and leaves. So our musicians come in, work together. Many of them have worked together before, but they're not a fixed group. And that's how they work. They rehearse, they try things. There's a basic level of understanding of the piece that happens before any rehearsal. And most of the pieces have been performed by these musicians elsewhere with other people. So it's a question of putting it all together, deciding on how certain transitions will be done, how certain things will sound, and then giving what at our festival is traditional, stunning performances. And that's what makes Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival truly unique. The level of players, the great repertoire, and the exciting experience of hearing this kind of music played in an intimate setting like St. Francis Auditorium.
Now, when you have people coming in from all over the place and playing in small groups together, maybe for the first time, or maybe some of them have played together before, basically you're putting a big premium on their rehearsal time. In other words, you've got to provide time and space for them to get to that point where the magic happens.
That's right. I mean, the rehearsal schedule that's put together by Linda Klosky on our staff is what we can describe as a 3 or 4 dimensional jigsaw puzzle.
Right.
So that to put get enough rehearsal time that won't interfere with the concerts and that the players will be able to go to their other rehearsals for other pieces with different musicians. And so that rehearsal schedule is a work of art that is created every year by Linda, and it provides for enough rehearsal for each piece to be really put together well.
Do the musicians then basically get to have a more extended, not vacation, but period of time of living in Santa Fe than they would have if there was just a group going in and out?
Yes. They're usually here for about a week, sometimes a little bit more than a week, and most of them play on 4 concerts during that week. So they're here for they spend a lot of time rehearsing and a lot of time performing, but they always have a good time while they're here. The golfers are always out playing golf between rehearsals, and the ones who are foodies are always finding some new place to go. The hikers are out hiking. I mean, everyone, all the musicians that come here have a great time.
Now, what are some of your favorite pieces that are being performed in the festival this year?
Well, one of my favorites is unfortunately already just about sold out, and that's Mahler's Das Lied von der Erde, the Song of the Earth. That will be with Susan Graham, our artist-in-residence, and tenor Paul Groves. David Zinman is conducting. This is the one piece that we have a conductor for because it's about 15 players and the singer, so it's much easier to put that together with a conductor.
What is there like a point, a breaking point, where it's too many players and you need a conductor?
It's usually more about the music than about the numbers. First of all, the more players you have, the more various ideas of phrasing and interpretation you can get. So having a conductor there eliminates all the differences. You have one person who's leading it, and so the rehearsals go by much more quickly for a large piece. Das Lied von der Erde is over an hour long. So it goes by much more quickly, it has much more control, and ultimately would be a better performance. And so that's what we have. But that's on the 25th and 26th of July. But as I said, it's just about sold out. We have so many pieces. I couldn't pick a favorite. There are some pieces that are new, not in the sense of being newly commissioned, and we have a number of those that we'll talk about, but pieces that are new to our ears. A wonderful piece by Reynaldo Hahn. He was born in Venezuela, grew up in Paris, was active in the 1920s and 30s. He knew Sartre. He wrote a book about Sarah Bernhardt. He was a friend of hers. But he wrote a beautiful piano quintet, piano and string quartet, that I have never heard live. I have a recording. I've never heard it live. It's a beautiful piece. And I'm sure that everyone else in the audience also has never heard it live because it's rarely played. So it's one of those hidden chestnuts. I mean, I know that you'll love it when you hear it,
right,
but no one's heard of it to say, oh, I want to go hear that piece. But it's Reynaldo Hahn, wonderful composer, Sunday the 1st and Monday the 2nd of August at St. Francis Auditorium. That, I think, is one of those pieces that when people go to the concert, they will come away thinking, what a find, what a wonderful discovery.
We're talking to Stephen Ovitzky of the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival. Yeah, and that's the, I suppose, fun and creativity of putting together a chamber music festival is taking things like that and giving them to the public.
Right, and Mark Nykrug, our artistic director, is always on the lookout for really wonderful pieces that are rarely performed. Last year we had this great Walter Braunfels quintet for strings. That was a real discovery. And big post-romantic piece, of wonderful performance as well. And I think the people who were there that had no idea what to expect walked out of there thinking, what a great piece. And I know that the Han will be the same thing this year.
So you have Susan Graham, and she's your artist in residence this year.
That's right. That's something new for us. And Susan is singing in four concerts. Now, she's one of the world's great mezzo-sopranos and has a very close New Mexico connection because she's from here and has a house here in Santa Fe as well. And on opening night, July 18th, and then on Monday, July 19th, she's singing The Deepest Desire, Four Meditations on Love by Jake Heggie, who wrote the piece for her. So Jake Heggie is coming to play piano on that. And they'll be doing those pieces. And then she's singing in the Mahler that I just mentioned the following Sunday and Monday.
And you also have some commissions, as you do every year.
Right. We're the only music festival in the country, or at least certainly the only chamber music festival, whose artistic director is a very active composer. And Mark has a very strong passion for new music, not just of his own, but of other composers. And I'm also very committed to new music. I've been involved with commissioning new music for the last 30 years. And we have, I think, a great lineup of new works, and the composers will be here. A young American composer, Cynthia Lee Wong, will be here for a piece for piano quartet. That'll be in August the 6th, on August 6th, that is. And then Chinnery Ung, who I haven't seen in 30 or more years. Chinnery is from Cambodia and writes great music with a lot of influence of Cambodian traditional music as well.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, and he's writing a piece called Akasa, called Formless Spiral, and we were co-commissioners of that. And
do they use traditional Cambodian instruments?
Well, he doesn't use Cambodian instruments, but he's written it for viola, cello, piano, percussion, and the Chinese pipa.
Okay.
And the great pipa virtuoso, Wu Man, will be here to play those performances.
And ladies and gentlemen, if you've never heard of any of this and you don't know what's going on, just check it out anyway.
Right.
Because it's such an interesting way of surprising yourself.
Well, she is one of the most amazing virtuoso musicians in the world. And in addition to playing the piece by Chinnery Ung, she and some friends are going to do a concert on Saturday, August 7th at 8 o'clock at St. Francis. She's made a recording where she plays pipa, another player plays the Ukrainian bandura, which is this string instrument, this plucked string instrument with 20-some-odd strings, and a banjo and a Ugandan ndongo.
Good heavens.
And they do this wild and wonderful mix of things. So if you hear like North Carolina banjo tunes, but there's a pipa playing in the background, or Chinese music with a bandura adding some beautiful color. And Wu Man and Friends is a really wonderful evening. And for people interested in world music of all kinds, that would be a great night on the 7th of August.
Well, and that to remind people about the Chamber Music Festival, there's always some unusual, genre-wise, some unusual evenings, including jazz.
Yes, this year the great jazz pianist Marcus Roberts and his trio will be with us Indian Market Weekend on Friday, the 20th of August at the Lenzic. And that'll be a terrific concert. He's one of the great straight-ahead jazz pianists working today. And we're delighted that he's here with his trio. And that's, again, the 20th of August.
Very many things going on at the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival. Stephen Ovitzky is the executive director, and Mark Nykrug, whom we spoke to not too long ago about his piece Healing Ceremony, which was its whole own event at the New Mexico, the University of New Mexico Cancer Center. He's the artistic director, and for more information, you can go to SantaFeChamberMusic.com, and you can call toll-free 888-221-9836 or locally here in Santa Fe 505-982-1890.
Right, and we hope to see all of you at the concerts beginning this Sunday.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned. I'm delighted now to welcome Arthur Z. He is a poet. He's the author of 8 books of poetry and 1 book of translation of Chinese poetry. And he has a new book. He's edited a new book called Chinese Writers on Writing, about which he will be talking at Collected Works Bookstore this coming Thursday at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is a book of all kinds of Chinese writers from, well, pretty much the early 20th century to the present. How did you decide to put this together, and how did you go about doing so?
I wanted to do a reading of modern Chinese literature, and that in itself is quite a complex task because there are writers, let me say, prose writers as well as poets in China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, writers who were expelled from China, writers who chose to leave, Chinese writers who left at different periods after the Second World War, after the Cultural Revolution, after the democracy demonstrations at Tiananmen in 1989. So there are Chinese writers in France, Canada, the United Kingdom, and the United States, as well as China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. So there are all sorts of tensions and complexities. But I chose 1917 as the starting point because that's the beginning of modern Chinese poetry written in the vernacular and not in classical Chinese. It's a clear break. And the other reason I focused on modern Chinese literature is there's such a huge lag time between what gets written and what is translated into English. So I felt like American readers at this point might know some of the ancient Chinese poets like Li Bai or Du Fu, but few American readers really know what's happened in China in the 20th century and even in the last 10 years.
It's striking reading through this book, and I can't say that I've read every essay by any means, but that the influence of the West on Chinese writers is significant, whereas the influence of Chinese writers on the West is perhaps negligible. I mean, a lot of Americans are interested in Eastern spirituality, but not necessarily literature.
I think that's an interesting point. One of the writers, Ji Shen from Taiwan, the founder of the modernist poetry movement in Taiwan, has a phrase where he says, horizontal transplantation rather than vertical inheritance. And what he means by that position is all of the translation of Western poetry, not just British poetry, but French, German, Latin American, these are waves of translations influencing modern Chinese literature. And if you look at American literature, you can say on the one hand the impact is small. But if you look carefully, I think you can also point out Ezra Pound, for instance, was deeply influenced by Chinese characters and the ideograms and his whole idea of juxtaposition. Poets like Gary Snyder are very influenced by Asia. So there is some impact. But again, I think there's a huge lag time. And there's often a misunderstanding. I mean, Ezra Pound didn't know Chinese, and he misconstrued how the Chinese language works. Gary Snyder understands it a little better. But you're right in the sense that there's a lopsided influence.
You grew up in New York, but speaking Chinese, did you also learn the writing system when you were young?
I did not. I grew up speaking Mandarin because my mother and father were born in Beijing and came to the States before the Second World War. And like many immigrants, they thought I should be as American as possible. And Chinese was spoken, but it wasn't emphasized. And it wasn't until I was formally writing poetry that I wanted to read the ancient poems in Chinese. And I studied Chinese at University of California at Berkeley. So that's where I learned the written language.
The written language is, to a Western sensibility, very, very difficult to even grasp how it works. Maybe you could tell us, I mean, of course it's a 20-hour conversation, but maybe you could tell us some of the fundamentals, and above all, how the way Chinese is written influences Chinese poetry and writing.
That could go on for hours. It's a wonderful topic to initiate. Let me say that ancient Chinese characters are often based on pictures or images in nature. So the character for sun is like a circle with a dot in it. The character for moon is a crescent. You can think of them almost as if they were petroglyphs at Tsangui or somewhere in the southwest. But the unusual thing about Chinese is juxtaposition. If you take the character sun and you juxtapose the character moon, you create the word bright. If you take a tree or plant and write the plant tip on fire, you create the character autumn. And if you put autumn in the heart, you create the character sorrow. So it's a very visceral, intensely visual language.
And basically, if you learn it, you already have those metaphors floating around in your soul.
Absolutely, absolutely. So classical Chinese poets use those aspects of the character in their written poetry. So Du Fu might have the rain radical appear visually across the horizon of the poem. But let me say modern Chinese is a very different language from classical Chinese because of all of the translations of Western technology, science, literature. Xi Chuan, one of the writers, says the distance between modern Chinese and ancient Chinese is beyond comprehension for a Western reader. It's as far as the distance between French and modern Chinese. And that's because, for instance, over 50% of the vocabulary of modern Chinese doesn't exist in ancient China. There's no television, radio, cell phone, atom bomb, electricity. All of those modern words had to be invented through connecting certain old Chinese characters and putting them to create strings of characters.
Whereas when we have new concepts and so on, we just spell them phonetically. We don't have to come up with pictures.
Right. So let me just say the situation of modern Chinese is a fascinating, complex one where you have the ancient Chinese characters, but you have all of these imports too. You have new vocabulary, new syntax, and really a huge kind of psychological pressure from Western languages and Western thinking applied onto the Chinese language system.
Really?
Yes.
What does that look like?
Well, in modern Chinese, you have what are called simplified characters. So many of the ancient derivations are stripped away so that people can read and write more quickly. But still in the characters, you have a kind of a sketch or a shadow of the tradition.
So do little children in Beijing learn ancient Chinese characters?
No, they're learning modern Chinese characters, what are called the pinyin, the simplified characters.
So we're talking to Arthur Zee about his new book, Chinese Writers on Writing. Let's talk about being a writer in China, which does not have a free speech clause in its constitution, and there's a very high cost to being a writer in China, particularly in certain times in history.
Let me start by saying or sharing experiences of contemporary Chinese poets I know who have left China who now live in the West. And one poet from China said in China there was so much pressure because there's so much attention and reverence paid to poetry. In the 1970s and 80s, they were like, those younger poets were like rock stars and they had huge followings. And their work was very carefully tracked by the authorities. When they came to America, they felt like they could write anything, but did it matter? Would anyone read what they had to write? Whereas in China, people were executed over a certain phrase. And that happens in the tradition of Chinese poetry. One emperor in prison was executed for writing the phrase, "The East Wind Will Rise Again." This is before the Song Dynasty is established. And that phrase was interpreted as a veiled call for revolution and uprising. But a lot of the modern Chinese poets have to be very careful about what they say and how those terms are couched. For instance, Yan Li's poem that I've included in this collection doesn't overtly talk about censorship, and yet the issue is clearly there.
So the writers who were exiled and who live in the West now, did they have to escape in order to save their own lives?
They did, or they felt they would be silenced. Gao Xingzhen, the Nobel laureate in fiction, who has an essay in here called The Art of Fiction, basically had a warrant out for his arrest, and he went abroad and never went back to China. A poet like Beidou left and has lived in 8 or 9 different countries And he's recently moved back to Hong Kong, and he's in a really unusual situation where Hong Kong is a separate entity, has accepted him back, but he has not been given formal permission to re-enter China, whereas many of the other poets who left China are now able to go back to China. It's a fascinating and complex situation. Let me say, in 1946, Winnie Daw, one of the early modernist poets in this collection, got up at a demonstration and gave a speech denouncing the Kuomintang government, and he was assassinated later that day. So poetry is taken very, very seriously in China. Less so right now, I have to say, but traditionally very, very important, and up until really the last 10 years, extremely important.
Less so right now. Is there a relationship between the declining importance of poetry and the rise of the kind of media-saturated world that China has become?
Absolutely. It's been said China is now a market economy. It's all about making money. It's all about selling things. And the audience and the position, prestige of poetry has shrunk considerably over the last 5 years. So in a really interesting way, contemporary Chinese poets feel marginalized in ways that maybe contemporary American poets do, too. That huge audience isn't there anymore.
Very interesting. Now, during the Cultural Revolution, poetry was suppressed and art was suppressed unless it met a kind of pretty narrowly defined aim of helping the people. I suppose it was the poetic equivalent of socialist realism art. Did anything good come from that period?
In China from 1966 to 76, basically all of the voices were silenced because you have some of the great modernist poets. Winnie Daw was assassinated. I Ching was labeled a rightist, and he was sent to hard labor in a coal mine for 10 years where he basically went blind. You have a lot of experimentation going on in Taiwan from 1966 to 76, but very little in China. But in 76, after Zhou Enlai's death and the opening up with Democracy Wall, you have the first unofficial poetry magazine in China, which is Beidou's Jintian Today magazine, which published a lot of the what are called Misty School poets, who were the first ones to begin writing a kind of poetry that expressed their dreams and aspirations and got away from the socialist realist agenda.
There were poets who were writing basically in secret and putting their work in their closet, who then later were able to bring a backlog of work out to the public.
Absolutely. And a lot of the poetry circulated in ways that are similar to the small press scene in America, where if you're not looking at the major publishers, you have poets who just get together and put together a small magazine or journal, or, you know, to make it more contemporary, online now. And that's happening in China all the time, where you have contemporary poems appearing on websites and then they disappear, and it's a constant thing where they might be concerned about being censored or whatever, but for a brief moment these poems appear and then they disappear. And for those other poets in the 1980s, yes, they are writing and they're accumulating poems in briefcases and they're making mimeographs and they're circulating them by hand. And so that whole idea of what they called underground publication was very much alive in the 1980s.
We're talking to Arthur Zee about his new book, Chinese Writers on Writing. So the essays in the book, and there are some poems in the book and pieces of writing and so on, and it, again, there's a great deal to explore, and it's kind of daunting for a Western reader to even enter this, and so I can't say anything of much use. One thing I did notice was a couple of different people had very visceral metaphors of light and blackness. Is that a particularly Chinese set of images?
I think so, in terms of yin and yang and polarities. Maybe the best thing would be to read a couple of short excerpts so listeners could get an idea. I tried to have although the focus are essays, I also tried to include poems that would support aesthetic positions. And maybe to give a listener some background, maybe a good place to start would be a paragraph from Gu Cheng, who's one of the Misty School poets. And this paragraph is called Poetry Lesson. So you have to remember this is in the 1970s, after the whole period of socialist, realist agenda and things opening up. It was a raindrop that first introduced me to poetry. On the way to my primary school, there was a spire-like pine tree, but whenever I passed by, it never spoke. Then one day, after a rain shower, when the world was fresh and clean, that pine tree suddenly was all a glitter with crystalline raindrops hanging from every needle. At that moment, I completely lost touch with my own being. Inside each single drop, I saw a rainbow floating. Each drop was full of the clear blue sky. Each drop held a new world for me. I knew then that a single drop of rain was able to contain everything and to distill everything within it. The world that sparkled in the raindrop was purer and more beautiful than the world in which we live our lives. Thus, a poem is just that, a raindrop glittering on some tree of the imagination. So for those Misty School poets, there's a lot of this kind of brilliance and clarity and excitement of discovering what language can do after having to sort of toe the socialist realist line for many years.
And I suppose there's a liberation in just simply being able to be introspective and observant, and a style of poetry that maybe in the United States has gone to a level of navel-gazing where you kind of wish they would engage with their society a little more.
Absolutely. As a point of contrast, a few years later, maybe I can read from a manifesto by Yu Zhen. This is translated into English for the first time, and over half of these works are being translated into English for the first time. Yu Zhen wrote this series of points about poetry in 1990 called The Brown Notebook, and you can see how different his perspective is from Gu Cheng. The process of writing poetry is the process of cleaning out garbage. A poet is not a genius or a romantic prince or a martyr. A poet is a worker in a factory, a language operator. To write real poetry is to refuse every metaphor. A successful poem means it has successfully cleaned all metaphors, therefore liberated its readers. Poetry is not a way of observing life, it is a way of living life. Poetry mocks those who look for depth and essence. Poetry is naming, it's as simple as that. Return to where the language came from. Return to the time before metaphor. How? I can't answer. It's poetry. And there Yu Zhen is struggling with the Chinese language, which he knows he has to use. So it's a fascinating paradox. We are in another interview.
In an interview, in the same book, he says, you know, I'm against metaphor, but I can't be because it's impossible to avoid.
That's right. A number of years later, I couldn't help juxtaposing those two points of view because you have that divided self or that tension revealed so intimately there, absolutely.
Arthur Z is a poet, and he's the editor of the new book, Chinese Writers on Writing, and once again, he'll be at Collected Works Bookstore this coming Thursday, the 15th of July at 6 in the evening. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, hasta mañana. Ciao.